scrambled eggs all over my face.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble. I'm Kit Garrison.
I'm Brian Gill.
I'm Richard Barden.
And this is Mad.
About
movies.
Da, 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 da!
You sound insane. You realize that?
Yeah.
The whole world gone crazy.
Seriously?
It's showtime.
Mad About Movies is your go-to podcast for all things cinema. Every week, we meet and talk movie news, movie rumors and rumblings, and break down a chosen movie of the week. Don't worry if you haven't seen it, because we'll warn you before we head into spoilers. And stay tuned till the end for weekly recommends, in which each of us suggests something awesome that you need to check out ASAP. And remember, you can find all of our episodes on our website at madaboutmoviespodcast.com. This week's movie of the week is what, Brian?
This week we're going to be talking about Bennett Miller's Foxcatcher.
Do you have any idea who I am? Some rich guy calls you on the phone. I wanted to speak with you about what you hope to achieve. What do you hope to achieve, Mark?
I want to be the best in the world.
Good.
Finally, guys.
Yes.
I feel like we've been waiting for this one for far too long.
Yes, because limited release.
Not only that, but this movie's been delayed a number of times, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure. Correct.
I feel like we were talking around this time last year about this movie, talking about how it was supposed to come out last Christmas season, and I think they wanted to sort of put it on the film festival circuit a little bit more, get the buzz up, take it to Cannes, and all that good stuff. And the buzz was pretty high coming into this for me, and you know, there's Oscar talk for a number of these performances coming into this as well. So, like I said, finally we get to talk about this. Yes, oh, the woes of limited release. Such a bummer sometimes. We live in a very, I feel like, big market, too. Top five market in the country in Dallas-Fort Worth. I would say the Bay Area, L.A., New York, Chicago. And it's really the only places bigger as far as a movie release, I would think, as far as the number of eyes that could see a movie.
Yes. So.
In Orlando.
Des Moines.
Des Moines.
Tampa. Florida's not part of this country.
Yes. Limited release is the bane of our existence. I despise limited release. It's a very antiquated bit that needs to go away.
It makes honestly no sense sometimes, and I understand the concept of independent cinema and distributors that don't have the time or budget to put into some of these movies. But when you have a movie that is in the running for the best film of the year.
Yes.
And it doesn't make money. It's because it wasn't out and nobody could go see it. It's not because it's not a good movie or people didn't want to see it. It's because they can't. It literally physically can't go see it. So.
Especially when you are pushing it as hard as the studio pushed Foxcatcher. We've been seeing trailers and posters and stuff for it for literally for months before it opened. And we could not see it for a month after it had been out. Like that's... And again, we live in the fifth biggest media market in the States. Like, that's insane. It's so frustrating that we have to deal with that kind of junk.
Yeah, here we are.
I think it should be a rule, law. If you're going to release your movie in less than, say, 500 or 800 theaters, then you also have to release it video on demand same day. You can charge $15 bucks. I don't care. I would have paid $15 to see this movie 2 months ago.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I agree. And there's still films yet to be seen by us that are in contention for this year. And, you know, once we hopefully get to see those in the next week or two, we'll do our best and worst of 2014 episode, which should come round out the month of January before we move fully on to 2015's offerings. And so here we are still with no inherent vice.
We get it this Friday.
We do. Okay, good. So that was another one that I'd circled that we hadn't gotten around to see. And American Sniper, I think, is wide release very
I think by
soon.
Next week we will have access to at least all the movies that are important, that are going to matter. We get Selma this weekend. We get Inherent Vice, American Sniper. So we can do it now, but we're like, we'd love to have done a top 10 episode the first week of January, but we can't.
And I'm going to be a jerk here.
Okay.
Because you guys are nice. Many of you are probably asking, hey, you guys are critics. You guys have a pretty large listenership. Why don't you guys get screeners? And we would love to get screeners, and we would love to join a critics association, especially locally here in the North Texas area.
Yeah.
Considering we probably have a bigger listenership/readership than most people in the critic association do, but they make that nearly impossible.
It's real fun.
Another chance here to rant about the local DFW Critics Association. They haven't updated their website in like 4 years something. And that's just inexcusable.
And we're and bigger they than wonder you and why... better than you, and we will crush you.
And if you harm a hair on Richard's head, we will burn your organization to the ground.
They wonder why print critics are becoming irrelevant. Well, it's maybe because they don't put any effort into what they already have access to. So, yeah, it's a bummer.
Yeah, this has been melancholy about movies.
This has been. This has been.
But seriously.
Yes.
We will come after you. If you don't listen to your organization.
So, yeah, we could do that. We could do our best and worst list episode, but it just wouldn't feel right to do that episode and then immediately after talk about Inherent Vice and American Sniper and all those, because that's just continuity. We're all about that on the show. So
we want to have all the information we can possibly get before we do that sort of thing.
Before we talk Foxcatcher, fellas, I have one a small thing that I want to talk about from movie news this week. So let's do that real quick.
Movie news.
Yes.
Rumors and rumbling.
That's awesome.
Let the filibustering begin.
So it is 2015, and it feels weird, of course, again. But this is a big year, fellas, for movies. We've been talking for the past couple years about how 2015 is going to be something big, something special. It can't be any worse than 2014, I think, especially for just box office numbers-wise. I think 2014 was a 19-year low. Not a very encouraging sign from that point. But, Brian, like you said, maybe people are moving more towards that video-on-demand style of viewing. So sometimes people will want to see a movie, but they know that in 2 months they can sit on their own couch and watch it in glorious high definition for basically cheaper than taking their kids out to see it or something like that. So a little bit depressing from that standpoint, but I think 2015 will reignite some public interest in movies. At least that's how it's looking right now.
I think there's two points to be made, because I've seen a ton of blog sites and stuff like that posting blurbs about how bad this is, the end of good, you know, of blockbusters, and the industry is so down and all this sort of stuff. And you're right, Kent, as you said, this is a 19 year low. It's really bad. But I think there's two points to that. And one is this is a bad year for blockbusters. This was just kind of a crappy year. We weren't really that stoked about most of what came out. Well, we talked about it going into the year of this did kind of feel like the redheaded stepchild of the movie industry, because next year is going to be so big, and 2013 was really big too. So it just kind of got left behind. So besides Guardians and I know Transformers did well both here and overseas, but there just weren't that many things to get excited about. And so I'm not willing to say, you know, the movie industry is in trouble or the theater industry is in trouble until we see how next year goes, because I think we're going to get a big bounce back on that. The second point, though, for me is part of the blame goes on the theaters themselves for not making the theater an enjoyable environment anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like that has been a major uptick this year of the number of movies I've been in where somebody has had their cell phone out the entire time, or somebody's been vaping in the movie, or just people being.
First
jerks.
Off, I have an addiction.
I'm trying to quit, okay?
Can I tell you guys, can I give you guys some cool news? I don't know if I've talked about this on the podcast, but a lot of people know I've been hanging around Dallas a little bit. No, but some of you may know I work for a technology company during the day. And have you guys played around with Oculus Rift at all? Are you familiar with it?
Yes.
I talked to you guys a little bit about it.
Yeah.
So one of the things I play with it on, and Oculus Rift is a VR, a virtual reality tool that actually uses your smartphone. So it's basically a little headset. You put your smartphone into the eye part of it, and it uses your move. It's just like when you did virtual reality in the 90s at the mall. You move around and everything moves around with it. But one of the coolest use cases that I've played around with on it is a movie theater simulator. And it's the craziest thing, Brian. It would trip you out. But you put this headset on, and it completely blocks everything out, and you tap the screen, and you are in a movie theater. So the screen is looks like it's 70 feet in front of you, even though it's maybe 2 inches. And you can look around. You're as you move your head, you look around. There, it's you have the best seat in the theater. You're right in the center of probably a 300 seat theater, and no one is in there with you. It's just all empty seats. But you can literally look up and count the tiles on the ceiling. You can see popcorn on the floor if you want. The seat next to you is right there. There's a cup holder, and it gives you that complete theater experience, but it could be on demand, like in your own house. That's you awesome. Know, it's pretty crazy. It really is awesome. For those of us that love watching things in that theater, movies in the theater, but also hate humans, this right. is a great this is a great kind of use case. And what am I looking, what's the word I'm looking for? Compromise in a weird
sure.
way. So I just want to share that with you yeah. guys on the thing. But look it up, the listeners. You guys should look it up. Oculus Rift, Samsung. Oculus Rift is its own company that's doing this, but they have one that they've kind of made in along with Samsung. And you put a Samsung phone in there, and all kinds of fun things can happen. Probably a lot cooler and more technically insane than a movie theater, but I'm a simple person and was most impressed by that.
Yeah.
So there's even popcorn on the floor in our virtual world, too.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah, and Yum. And God, a weird couple, like, yeah. kind of just in the back.
Is the floor sticky in the virtual yeah. world?
Can I tell you guys the weirdest movie story ever? Because we have a short episode this week. It's not a lot of movie news. I don't think I've ever told you guys this. So when I was, like, late high school, early college in the summer, I was working, and my mom – I always had Mondays off. So my mom and I had this tradition where we would kind of go on, like, these – cool like hangouts on Mondays in the morning. So we'd go to California Pizza Kitchen because we're awesome, and then we'd go see a movie, whatever came out that Friday. We'd go like Monday at like, you know, 11:30 in the morning when no one was there. So we went to see Mission Impossible 3 one time with Philip Seymour Hoffman, Tom Cruise, and we're about 15 minutes in. It's delightful. It's just us and one other guy in the theater, and we're sitting there, and we're about 20 minutes into the film or whatever. And another gentleman walks in, and you just kind of think, oh, he's just late or something. I don't know. It was a little weird because it was pretty late into the movie, but whatever. And he just kind of very methodically walks up the steps, walks into the theater, like into the row where the other random guy in the theater is sitting, and just beats him without mercy. There's
oh my
blood
gosh.
Everywhere. Not a word is exchanged. So we leave the theater, not the building, just the theater we were in, and like go tell a manager, like, some crazy person just walked in. And we didn't know if there was like, you know, beef between the two. Maybe he knew he was at the theater and he was going to settle some hash, or if it was just like a random face yeah. beater. Well, it turned out it was the latter.
Oh, God.
The police came, and this guy just, his deal was he just liked to walk in the movie theaters. And this, the guy we found out later who got beat up was like a 69-year-old guy.
Oh, my gosh. And
anyway, the assaulter tried to flee the scene, but he didn't own, what do you call him, a car? And so he was just kind of wandering this, while cops chased him like Benny Hill.
Nice.
Just sort of like, and just wander on this empty parking lot to movie theater at like 12:15 on a Monday afternoon in the summer of 2006. And it was the weird, and they just gave us all these free passes, like, please God, don't tell anyone this happened. And it was the weirdest movie going experience of my life. So I say all that to say, yes, that also happens in the virtual reality.
That was actually the inspiration.
That's encouraging.
Oculus Rift.
Yeah. So every fifth movie you watch, this crazy person comes in.
This conversation's making me never want to go to a movie theater again. I don't know how it's warped into that, but
I don't know. I've been in plenty of theaters recently where I had hoped somebody would come in and beat the tar out of somebody. I mean, somebody specific, not just a random guy, but
yeah.
You know,
no, I know
the people who are bringing a 4-year-old into an R-rated movie and eating Genghis Grill, like in the movie theater. I'd be okay if they got beat up a little bit. That actually happened, guys. Yeah.
So I would have actually preferred it over A Million Ways to Die in the West, but it can't be undone.
Yeah.
No, but I just wanted to talk a little bit and look at kind of ahead to 2015 and sort of the upcoming release schedule. And I guess we can talk, since we're actually in 2015 now, how the outlook is looking for this year. So I guess we should start off with sort of the obvious ones here. Coming up later this year in May, we have the Avengers Age of Ultron. The spring is kind of laxed, it looks like, as far as release stuff goes.
You're skipping one.
Fast.
Yeah. April 3rd, I think. 1st, something like that.
and Pitch Perfect too. I mean, fast.
Yeah, I mean, Avengers Age of Ultron is a hyped one. We also have Jurassic World later this year, which we're getting a full trailer to both of those fairly soon, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm assuming we'll be talking about those in the next couple weeks, so look forward to that. Of course, Fast, or I should say Furious 7,
yes,
coming out later this year. Does this rank on your number one anticipation list? I know it probably does for you, Richard, right?
It kind of fluctuates between Star Wars, which, believe it or not, I am excited for, Tomorrowland, which I'm really excited for, and Fast.
Wow.
Fast, I just know I'm just going to be a big old bucket of tears the whole time.
Yeah. That's quite a list you've got going. It could be worse. It definitely could be worse.
Yeah. And Paul Blart, too. I forgot. Oh. Also, Paul Blart, too, I'm excited about.
Paul Blart, Mall Cop, too.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Give it the respect it's deserved. Yeah.
We have Mad Max sequel called Fury Road, starring Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron, coming out later this year. Kind of an unnecessary reboot / sequel. Those are to be expected in this day and age. Speaking of unnecessary reboot / sequel, we have Terminator 5, Terminator Genesis, with a Y.
Yeah. So you know it's good. Because I feel like anytime in a title you can replace the letter that is supposed to be there with another letter, you're just letting everybody know this is the most awesome movie of the year.
Well, exactly. When has that not worked out?
Yeah.
Hey, can I read you guys the cast for Paul Blart Mall Cop 2? Because I'm on this now. Kevin James returning as Paul Blart. Molly Shannon. Neil, second build, by the way, Molly Shannon. Neil McDonough. Lonnie Love. And Anna Gasteyer. Oh, and Nicholas Turturro. The other Turturro. So you know this is a piece. Because
it's fantastic.
The first Paul Blart made a lot of money, so you think at least some people would be like, all right, I'll do it, because it made $200 million or whatever. But the best they could get was B-Team Turturro.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Not he goes good, to guys. Vegas in this one, though. He goes to Vegas, though.
Paul Blart was one of the three movies that was playing on repeat on the cruise that I went on 5 years ago. So I watched parts of it about 100 times. That's why I will never go on another cruise, the main reason.
I watched
Prince of Persia.
Oh, jeez. Just broke my spirit.
In its entirety, Brian, with commercials. Oh, I mean, all the way through.
Gosh.
You missed, Brian, you missed our Jake Gyllenhaal Prince of Persia conversation couple weeks ago when we talked Nightcrawler.
Good grief.
Always a good time
to like that combo. Movie. Yeah. I liked Prince of Persia, Brian.
Really? I don't believe you.
No, yeah. I didn't. You know what, though? Kent heard this, but I'll make it quick. I didn't, and the listeners heard it too, but who cares about them? I didn't mind the story that much. I think the guy that wrote the story, who also wrote the video game, was not bad. I hated the dialogue and acting of Prince of Persia and the effects.
But I've only seen it the once, but I believe I gave it like a B- or C+, something like that, where you're like, it was a movie.
It was way better than I thought it would be.
Sure.
Yeah.
I said in that episode, and I'll say it again, Jake Gyllenhaal is a lot of things. One thing he isn't is Persian.
That's just like your opinion, man.
No, that's actually fact. Yeah. We have coming up later the conclusion.
Pangea, bro.
The conclusion to one of this year's biggest films, The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2.
Yes.
Which I'm assuming will be quite the fanfare. This spring, Matthew Vaughn's Kingsman: The Secret Service. Mm-hmm. Heard anything about this one? I've heard it's getting pretty decent reviews. From early buzz.
It's starting to win me over. I was not into it the first seven times I saw the trailer, but I'm starting to get beaten down into, that might not be bad.
Yeah, it's 100% right now.
Yeah.
An early indication.
I hope it's good, because I'll say this. Every year I write, for my blog, I write most anticipated movies of the year, and I break it into two parts so that I can do 10 movies for the first half of the year and 10 movies in the second half. And the first half, I sat down yesterday, the day before, to make my list and kind of structure the whole thing, and I could not find 10 movies that I was legitimately excited about. Like, there's a bunch of movies like the Taken 3s of the world and the Kingsman where I'm like, I'll see it. I don't mind. I'm not going to hate it probably, but I'm not genuinely excited about it. And in the back half of the year, I think And we don't even know what the, you know, the Oscar contenders and that sort of thing are going to be yet, because those usually pop up as the year drags on. But I could
besides the second best exotic Marigold Hotel.
I mean, that's clearly number one on my
and
list.
And Mordecai.
Yeah. Okay. Oh gosh. Go ahead.
Jeez. I could count like 15 or 16 movies in the back half of the year that I was legit excited about. So it's going to be a very backloaded year, I think. Not to say I'm not super stoked about Avengers and Furious 7 and Tomorrowland and
freaking Star Wars, man. Come on.
Well, yeah, that's a given. What's the Ron Howard one? In the Heart of the Sea.
The Heart of the Sea.
I'm really excited about that. That looks really good to me.
That's coming out in the next couple months. So
yeah, that's like March.
We'll actually be having a podcast on that one fairly soon. Yeah. Speaking in podcast terms,
listen, don't be scared off because our best episodes, if you're new to the show,
it's true.
Our best episodes are normally the worst movie. So these next few months, even though there's not much coming out and we will strain to see these things, it may end up being the best episodes of your beloved Mad About Movies.
Yeah.
Still waiting on that Draft Day sequel because that will be good.
You See Me Too. Is that 2016?
That's next year. Yeah, unfortunately.
Oh, man.
I think we get that and Batman v Superman like pretty much back to back, though. So,
double feature.
Yeah, can't wait. We have Inside Out, the Pixar film, coming out this summer. Trailers are already released for that. It looks to be something special, of course, hopefully. We have Jupiter Ascending.
Oh,
in the first couple months.
That's
next
the
month,
one
actually.
To look for, listeners. Yeah. That's the one that may be quite enjoyable for
I'm going to go to the dentist beforehand
pleasures.
And just Novocaine up.
Get
some teeth pulled to make it a perfect day.
I'm not at all excited about seeing that movie, but I am really excited about talking about it with you guys.
I'm going to go to the dentist after seeing the movie so I can end the day.
I'm
going
to try as hard as I can to veto that in favor of Seventh Son. Because those are, believe it or not, the same day release. Yeah. So
really? I was thinking about doing an Inherent Vice Taken 3 double feature this weekend, but that might top it.
We do have Taken 3 this weekend.
Taken 3 is like 50% on Rotten Tomatoes right now.
Wow.
That means it's good.
Oh, three fresh and three rotten, so it hasn't gotten very
But I'm telling you, that means it's good. If that kind of Liam Neeson movie is 50%, that means it's going to be good.
I really enjoy Taken 1. Taken 2 is really bad. But
I saw Taken 2.
I'll give it a chance.
Did we podcast Taken 2?
No, we didn't.
No,
that was.
No, I don't think I saw it.
But I will tell you a major plot point involves.
Spoiler alert, listeners.
Yeah, spoiler alert for Taken 2. So Liam Neeson
ago,
gets taken, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Liam Neeson gets taken, and one of the ways that he figures out where he is he has his daughter, who is miles away. It seems she is in a hotel room up high. And she throws grenades out the window so that he can hear the boom and he can tell how far away she is and kind of pinpoint his location.
You mean people don't have echolocation built into their nervous systems? I don't.
Yeah.
It's not a trait.
It was something.
That's insane. No, the funniest part about Taken 3, and I don't know if we'll do an episode on it, but I just want to say this tidbit. Hopefully we do. The fact that Liam Neeson's like, there's no way I'll do another Taken. I'm done. This is it. And like, what if we pay you $50 million? Okay, I'm in. That's literally what went down. So.
He got like 30 up front plus some back end.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane.
So he just has to show up in Liam Neeson all over the place, and he's good.
Slapstick. Crazy characters.
The two Hemsworth films prior to Avengers coming out, Black Hat. It looks pretty bad. It looks like a cyber thriller, which those are always pretty lame.
What are you doing, Michael Mann?
Was that movie with Ryan Phillippe and Tim Robbins as Bill Gates?
Ooh, I don't know. Many of my Ryan Phillippe filmography is lacking.
The Lincoln Lawyer?
Well, it should be because he was freaking Dixon Piper.
He was.
You guys remember Antitrust?
Yes.
Rachel Lee Cook?
Yes.
And the hot English girl. Oh, man, I've seen that like 30 times. It's terrible. Claire Forlani. She was a total babe in the late 90s.
Claire Forlani.
This looks like if Michael Mann reshot that movie, but it looks like the technology is still the same. I don't understand.
It looks like it looks amazing, and everything else is terrible. Because yeah. Michael Mann knows how to shoot a movie, but man, you need to come on, dude.
Yeah.
The other Chris Hemsworth film we mentioned earlier, Ron Howard's In the Heart of the Sea, is about the story that inspired the story of Moby Dick.
Yes.
So this could be something cool, and I love Ron Howard, so yep. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, my girlfriend read that book and said it's outstanding.
Great.
So
we have Neil Blomkamp's newest effort, Chappie, coming out.
Short Circuit 3.
Mm-hmm. Basically Short Circuit 3 / District 10.
I like Blomkamp, though. I'm excited I do like to see what he does. So.
Producer Steven maintains that Short Circuit 2 is the greatest movie ever made. Not kidding. That's his number one film of all time.
Definitely arguable, but...
Not Short Circuit 1.
Yeah.
Short Circuit 2.
Well, Short Circuit 1 is terrible, but I was a big Short Circuit 2 fan as a kid.
As a kid.
The airplane scene. Yeah, like the model airplanes, pretty powerful.
Well, this movie stars Di Antwoord, so we know it's going to be good.
Oh.
Yeah. We have Tomorrowland, of course, coming out later this year, the sci-fi thriller, or sci-fi blockbuster, I should say, from Disney and Brad Bird and Damon Lindelof. So we'll have to look forward to that. Teaser trailer is pretty exciting.
Yes.
Definitely qualifies as a teaser. We have a live-action Cinderella that Kenneth Branagh is bringing us from the directorial chair that Disney is also bringing to us in the first half of 2015. I believe that's a spring release, keeping with the tradition of Oz the Great and Powerful and Alice in Wonderland and movies
and
like
Maleficent,
that.
Yep.
And Maleficent coming
Snooze
out.
Fest,
yep. Snooze Fest. Snooze Fest to kick off the year, so we're quite used to those.
I do like Kenneth Branagh, though, as a director.
Oh, I do, too.
And Hayley Atwell is in that movie as well.
Oh, Richard. Okay. There you go.
I like her.
We have, believe it or not, a Quentin Tarantino film released this year. The Hateful Eight will come out this fall. So there's an Oscar one to circle. From early indications, I'm guessing will be The Hateful Eight. The screenplay alone was very well publicized last year. So I'm looking forward to see his screen version of The Hateful Eight. Despicable Me spinoff called Minions. And that looks
that didn't already come
annoying.
Out. No. I swear that came out.
No.
July.
Unfortunately, those Despicable Me movies come out, but all you ever see is the Minions anyway. So yeah. I don't understand the point of this.
Kids love them.
Yeah,
kids
they do.
Love them.
Yep. We have a trailer for Ant-Man is dropping in a few days. Marvel's Ant-Man that comes out this year. So look forward to that conversation in the coming weeks. And I guess we should wrap up this conversation by talking about the only movie coming out this year, in my opinion, The Wedding Ringer, starring Josh Gad and Kevin Hart, coming.
I will say that the movie's not going to be good, but it is the best-looking Kevin Hart movie I've ever seen, by, like, a lot. Like, I can at least see how that movie got made.
It's basically Hitch. Isn't it just a remake of Hitch?
But, I mean, Hitch made, like, $150 million or whatever. I mean, I know Will Smith is...
Yeah.
We like Will Smith more than Kevin Hart.
No, Kevin Hart's a movie star. I mean, Kevin Hart movies make money when a lot of other quote unquote movie stars movies do not make money. So not
he's
like
more of a movie dwarf planet. I wouldn't go full star.
Sure. But they cost nothing to make and they always come out very profitable. So I can't blame Hollywood for making Kevin Hart movies. I just wish that as a society we would decide, you know what, we're done. We've got enough. We've got the Ice Cube movie.
He seems like such a nice guy, too. He really does seem like a super nice guy. Kevin Hart does.
Other notable films I should round out before we move on to our Foxcatcher talk, guys. Mission Impossible 5.
Yes.
Coming out this year. Pitch Perfect 2. SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water. Coming out. 50 Shades of Grey, the film.
Kill me.
Another Kevin Hart affair with Will Ferrell called Get Hard. Dude. Also coming out, we have the Fantastic Four reboot.
Oh, Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, mild excitement for that one.
With Miles Teller.
Because of Josh Trank, the director.
And Josh Trank.
I hate Miles Teller, though. Even though Whiplash rules, I'm sure it's just... I still hate that movie from last year.
Yeah. What was that called?
Y'all really
Spectacular
y'all,
Now.
There's, y'all hate that way... Y'all Y'all put way more too much thought into like hating that movie. Just move on.
I think because I went into it really expecting it to be really good.
Totally.
Really? I expected it to be like what it was. So just a,
it was
like 98% high school.
Right. I thought that was going to be a great movie.
Yeah. It was like 98% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it had a good trailer, and it was abysmal. I would rather watch Antitrust with Ryan Phillippe and Tim Robbins.
No way.
The movie was pointless.
Oh, it was pointless, but there are a lot more movies.
Cheyenne Woodley, that's when she got, you know, that was just, she lost it for me. Yeah.
The reboot of Peter Pan coming out this summer, Pan, it looks kind of pretty ridiculous.
Hugh Jackman.
I like Hugh Jackman, but I just I'm not anticipating Pan. I love Peter Pan way too much for them to do anything else to it. Honestly,
I saw the trailer for it today on the the big screen, and it looked good. So that, I mean, from an aesthetic standpoint, it looked good. I hadn't seen it in a movie theater till today.
We have Ted 2 coming out. We also have, like I mentioned earlier, Mordecai with Johnny Depp. We have a Magic Mike sequel, and we have Seventh Son, and that's really it. And, of course, rounding out the year, we have the Peanuts film and the Adam Sandler Pixels starring Josh Gad.
Looks like it could be interesting. Just
looks like a Wreck-It Ralph, live-action Wreck-It Ralph, basically, with that.
And I'm really excited about The Good Dinosaur, too, the Pixar. We're getting two Pixar movies this year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cool.
Really? That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, fun.
Well, lots to look forward to.
Hey, guys, we've been talking about 2015 since we started this podcast. Back when this podcast was a radio show.
Yeah.
We used to be excited about 2015. It was years and years ahead of us. And we are here, gentlemen. And let's enjoy the movies this year. Let's just get to April and let's have some fun.
That's right.
Well said. And on that note, guys, let's move on and talk Foxcatcher.
Coach DuPont has a vision. He would like Foxcatcher to be the official training site for the national team.
What's he get out of all this?
What are you thinking? This is it. This is all that we've ever wanted.
Mark, you have been living in your brother's shadow your entire life. It's your time now.
Brian, I'll let you start this episode off. You're the first person to see this of the three of us, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
You had to go out to a modern art museum to see
this movie. Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of crazy circumstances, but talk to us about your anticipation for the movie and general thoughts on Foxcatcher.
I was very excited about this movie and have been for a long time. As Kent mentioned at the outset, we were supposed to get this last year, and then it got bumped for whatever reasons, I think to finish off some stuff and put it in a better release year, too. Last year was pretty stacked Oscars-wise, and this year is not. So I think it gave it a better chance to get some awards and all that good stuff. I love this cast. I never would have guessed that Channing Tatum would be an actor that I really look forward to from a performance standpoint. 5 years ago, that just never would have crossed my mind. But he's so talented, so I was excited to see that. And of course, as you know, we're all big Steve Carell fans here, and seeing him take on a completely different role than anything he's ever done before was very exciting. So it's a weird movie. It's very quiet. Which kind of took me by surprise. It's to call it a slow burn, I think would undersell it a little bit. Like there are long stretches within the movie where really nothing happens, but you're never you're far from bored. I think the longer it goes between real events taking place or explosive violence or actions or whatever. The longer it goes between those things, the tenser you get, and the more, I think, and for me at least, the more enthralled I kind of became with what was happening on screen. Because really what you've got is three great actors, and I've never been a big Ruffalo fan, but he might be the best part of the movie, honestly, for me. Anyway, you've got three great actors who are just acting, and Bennett Miller just, I don't know, he took a very unique direction in how he was going to tell this story. It's a very odd story, and I'm sure there are way more facets to it than what you're going to get in the 2 hour runtime. But anyway, overall, I was very, very impressed, and it's grown on me since I saw it. It was a very strange theater experience. I had to see it like a modern art museum, which is a great theater, but it attracts a strange crowd, and it's not necessarily, you know.
Was it Dallas or Fort Worth?
Fort Worth. Okay. And I love the modern in Fort Worth. And I see a couple movies a year there, usually like documentaries and stuff like that. But for whatever reason, this was planned for one weekend. And so anyway, it's a strange experience because that theater doesn't have the greatest speakers and the screen is a little bit small compared to what I might get at, you know, a big multiplex or whatever. And so it almost made it to where like the audience was a part of the movie, which can be good and bad. So that's just a personal experience. But just as a movie overall, I was very impressed. I think all three of these actors, we'll talk about more as we go, I'm sure, but I think all three of them deserve a lot of attention. Bennett Miller did a great job with, there's only like five or six explosive scenes in the movie, and I think he made them pop so, so very well. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, Richard.
You know, Bennett Miller is an interesting director because he's someone that came out of nowhere in a way with Capote. He grew up with Philip Seymour Hoffman. They were like childhood friends and came up together. That's why Philip Seymour Hoffman's in so many of his movies. And, you know, but his movies, he honestly hasn't made really a bad one yet. And he's not really thought of yet in that upper tier of kind of the younger, you know, with the PTAs. Mm-hmm. The Tarantinos and that kind of generation of directors. And I'm not sure after watching this that he doesn't belong at least close to there.
Yeah.
His movies definitely have a feel and look to them. And it's kind of an interesting blend of like a little PTA, a little Fincher, a little, you know, and, but you're right. He operates in the sparse really well.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. And he really understands that and how to make that not boring and how to really make you thirsty in a weird way for more, which is, it's a fine line, right, man? Cause it can also just be boring as crap when done wrong. And, cause Capote has some, just in that movie too, just you're kind of, there's some stretches where not a lot's going on, but you're so nervous because of the darkness and a lot of just aesthetics of it. And the level of performance that he's able to get out, I think he comes from an acting background. So I think, you know, he's not someone that, you know, there's two types of directors, right? There's, or I guess three. There's the cinema, basically the glorified cinematographer that just know how to shoot something. And then there's the person that really knows how to direct performance. And then there's those rare guys that are good at both. He really knows how to direct performance. And I think, you know, he's great. His movies aesthetically look great too. He shoots a movie great, but he really is almost a theater director in the way he just begs these performances out of all of his actors, and they're large and they're intense and they're gripping and they operate in a way that the material, even if the material is like I said sparse, you're just glued to these people. And he casts really well. A lot of it helps that when Philip Seymour Hoffman's your best friend in previous movies, that's a good best friend to have when you're casting actors. But, you know, now with him gone and finding someone like Carell, who I've said forever and on this podcast a bunch of time, I think is one of the best like three or four actors in the world. And I, you know, being from Dallas, Brian and I can tell you, people always, we always get angry because for those of you who don't follow sports, we have a player that's played in Dallas we mentioned on the podcast a lot, named Dirk Nowitzki. Dirk Nowitzki is a weird player because he's very tall, but he's a very good shooter. And people always say he's the best, you know, one of the best big man shooters of all time. And Brian and I always say, you can remove big man from that. He's just one of the best shooters of all time. Well, that's how I always feel about Carell. They always say he's one of the best comedic actors in the world. Well, you can go ahead and remove comedic because he's a fantastic actor. And he's nuanced in ways that hardly anyone else is. And he's smart and he's captivating and he takes his time and he really gets in it. But he oftentimes, so far at least, has played characters that are not so much a complete metamorphosis of him. You know, you look at something like Little Miss Sunshine, which I thought he's fantastic in, something like The Office, which is silly and goofy, but he's utterly unbelievable in it. And I don't think you could put that many of our great – I don't think Leonardo DiCaprio could do The Office in the subtle way that Steve Carell could.
No question.
I really don't. But they haven't really been transformative performances in terms of the physicality of it and things like that, like this one was. And so he was great in recognizing – that goes to Miller finding him and trusting him with that role when I don't think a lot of directors would. And he's really able to get that. And like you said, Brian, Tatum and Ruffalo, I think are both acquired taste for their respective fans. There's people that really love Mark Ruffalo, and there's people that they're really similar in that way, where they're kind of 50% people really like what they do, and the other 50% are, I don't think dislike, but are always kind of like wary of it, right? I think Ruffalo and Tatum both get that. They were both excellent as well, and I thought, you know, we were talking earlier about The Spectacular Now, and I'll shut up because I've been talking for 4 minutes. We were talking about The Spectacular Now, and that was a movie we went into with large expectations, and were really let down by. And this was something that I had just enormous expectations for, given the talent involved, and it lived up to those. I think it was a really excellent, just slow burn of a brutal movie, and I really enjoyed it, and really fascinating story too. And we'll talk about that sooner. But Kent, you go ahead. Now you can do your 25-minute monologue, and I'll sit over here and drink water.
It might not be that long. For me, this is definitely a slow burn. That's a good word to use to describe it. I don't know if it was worse than I expected, but it was just different than I expected. I expected this to be more of a thriller, honestly. More of twists and turns than it ended up having. To me, it felt more like a biopic or a biographical thriller than it did a thriller per se. I think the trailer sort of lent itself to more expectation in my opinion for the events that occurred. I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I really didn't research this at all, the actual story behind this. So, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. And there's a scene in the movie, and it's also in the trailer, where John DuPont, Carell's character, just walks in the training facility with the gun. And you're just like, what is going to happen? Mm-hmm. At least I thought that. And it ends up in the movie being not as serious as it, you know, could have or should have been. And he's just sort of in there to rile up the troops. And people don't – like, he walks in with the gun and people just kind of glance over at him. Like, it's no big deal. Oh, John DuPont's walking in here with a gun. Like, I figured somebody would tackle him or something. Like, holy crap, he's got a gun. You know, that doesn't happen. So I thought it was going that direction. Not to say that I'm disappointed by the direction it went, but that's just where I expected it to go. And I was also anticipating to be talking about Steve Carell a lot more. But, I mean, there are three very strong performances in this film. And I think Ruffalo and Channing Tatum deserve more credit than they're getting.
Yeah,
in this case, I think they might be better than Carell in this movie. Although Carell's performance is transcendent, and we'll talk more about it here in a bit. But I was just, Channing Tatum is something special. He really is. This is a fantastic performance. I mean, he really transforms into this character, not physically enough to the level that Carell does, of course. But I mean, his mannerisms, his movements. His entire attitude changed for this. And he's a likable person, but, I mean, he does a lot in this movie that you don't like him, and he does a lot that you do like him. I mean, this is a guy that can make an audience feel any way he wants them to, and you don't see that very often. But I was blown away by Channing Tatum in this movie. I just wanted to say that up front. And also Ruffalo. Brian, you mentioned it a little bit. We're not big Ruffalo people on the podcast. I think we've given him a hard time for Now You See Me enough times in the past. and some of his other work in recent years. So not always great to see him, but man, was he good in this. I must admit, it took me a while to even recognize him, to be honest, especially in the beginning when he's lurching around like a gorilla.
Yeah.
When him and Mark Schultz, Channing Tatum's character, are working out together and stuff and sort of sparring together. Bennett Miller really gave these guys opportunities to act and not just act like two characters sitting across from each other and having a dialogue back and forth. I mean, they were able to get into this movie physically from every angle that they possibly could. I mean, these guys, he gave them an opportunity to transform into these characters, you know, and that's something that we saw with Moneyball and Jonah Hill and of course Brad Pitt and, you know, Seymour Hoffman's performances, Oscar winning in Capote. So it's to be expected, but man, I think when it's all said and done, I don't know if this movie will get the recognition it might deserve. I don't know if this is a Best Picture front runner right now. I think it'll get it's you know, in the top 10. It's a nomination worthy, but I don't think at least anybody in my circle or people I have talked to about it consider this the best film of the year. But I think you can make an argument for these performances. You know, it'll just be really interesting to see what ends up happening with this. And I'm sure Steve Carell will get a nomination, right? For this. I'm sure Channing Tatum will as well.
I think Carell is a definite. Tatum may get lost in the shuffle. And
I think this is the movie that it's that, you know, what Little Miss Sunshine was for Carell. He didn't get nominated for that, did he?
No.
Yeah, it always takes two, I think. Like, I feel like Jim Carrey's mistake was not making another serious movie before Truman Show.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to have one that establishes that I'm serious and then a second one that you can get nominated for. And I feel like this will be Tatum's, oh, well, this guy can actually act. And then whatever his next serious movie is, probably Jupiter Ascending, he'll get nominated for it.
Well, the pointy ears will put it over the top, I'm assuming.
Jeez.
No, I really think that Carell has a shot at this. But I don't feel like supporting actor is a big stacked category this year. That's the only reason I say That's that true. About Channing yeah. Tatum. I feel like the lead actor, there's a lot of people that we've mentioned, you know, Michael Keaton, of course. I think Ralph Fiennes actually has a shot at leading actor for Grand Budapest. I think that's just a fantastic performance as well. But I don't feel like supporting actor is a category that's I mean, of course, Aaron Paul's performance in Exodus, Gods and Kings is probably going
to
be up.
Yeah, right now we have for Golden Globes for supporting. Yeah.
That's where Ethan Tatum is in trouble.
I think it would be Carell lead actor and then Channing Tatum supporting. That's what I would think.
Well, the Golden Globes have it as Ethan Hawke. The opposite? Hawk. No. These are supporting actors for motion picture. Ethan Hawke, Robert Duvall, Edward Norton, J.K. Simmons, and Mark Ruffalo. So the issue is with Ruffalo and Tatum splitting the vote, I think Ruffalo will get it. The nomination, that is, not the win.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'll both get nominated. I just feel like Ruffalo probably is a little more established in that award scene, and I think he'd get the nod, and he's older, over Tatum.
Yeah, maybe. The movie revolves around Channing Tatum's character. Yeah. I mean, that's the only reason I could see him getting more recognition for it. And I seriously think, if I was to rank those three performances, it's like Tatum 1, and then Carell and Ruffalo are 1, B, and C. You know,
yeah,
they're right up. I mean, we're comparing apples to apples here.
Yeah, honestly. They're all tremendous, and they all deserve it. I don't know if they're all going to get it, but they definitely all deserve it. The physical transformation that Tatum and Ruffalo especially undertook for their roles, like actors, they don't get credit for bulking up and physically becoming a character if it's a big guy. It's only like when Christian Bale loses 50 or 60 or 80 pounds for the Machinist. You know, things like that is where we tend to pay the most attention to that. But they had – both of those guys had that wrestler gait down to a T.
Oh, man, and yeah. Just,
I mean, they had
– the scene where Channing Tatum is introduced to the Foxcatcher Farms – wrestling facility, and John DuPont, Carell's character, just takes him into the wrestling workout room, and it's just a wide shot, and Channing Tatum just starts basically working out by himself.
Yeah.
He looks like a technically trained wrestler. I'm sure that Tatum had a wrestling experience in the past. If not, I mean, what a commitment to learn all that, you know, and study it.
The opening scene, pretty much, where Ruffalo and Tatum start kind of sparring or whatever you call it, was kind of a mesmerizing scene because it's very quiet, but this, the pops and the hits and the various moves that they're making, I thought that was a stunning scene, which is very kind of an odd thing to get really excited about that early in a movie, but I felt like it introduced those characters perfectly and kind of showed you, okay, these two dudes brought it. This is not just we're gonna go out here and be wrestlers. Like they see, you got the impression that they had really studied what they were doing and who they were playing.
Yeah. What how do we feel about Steve Carell moving forward as a serious actor? Do you think this is a one-off, like you know, he'll do one serious film every couple years and get, you know, get people talking about him, i.e. like Jonah Hill does. Or do you think he's going to start moving down this more serious path and not do, you know, the incredible Burt Wonderstone 2 right after this or something, you know? He's got a lot of potential for both sides of his career, unless they make another Evan Almighty. That might
he's got his next movie sounds like a laugh riot. It's directed by Peter Sollett, co-stars Ellen Page, Julianne Moore, and Michael Shannon, who's hilarious. New Jersey car mechanics Stacy Andre and her police detective girlfriend Laurel Hester both battle to secure Hester's pension benefits after she was diagnosed with a terminal illness.
Oh man!
So it's definitely
who's
a
the
happy
director.
It's a Happy Madison joint. I'm kidding. It's Peter Sollett, who did Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
Nothing else.
That sounds like it'll be small. That'll be the what was it called? The movie he did, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. Remember that one?
Yeah.
Last year, wasn't it? 2013.
And then he's got a movie called Acme, which apparently
it's a Looney Tunes.
Movie, right?
Yeah,
with the Bad Santa guys.
Okay,
so. That's always got, according to IMDb.
I mean, the real question is, we're talking about this year's awards show. So will he get nominated for Foxcatcher or Alexander's The Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day? I mean,
that's Jennifer Gardner's picture. I mean, she carries that.
She does. Steals the show.
Yeah.
Can't take that from her.
She has that and Draft Day this year. So things looking up for.
And those Capital One commercials.
Yeah.
So,
no. Let's talk more specifically about this performance by Carell. A little weird to see Carell in something so serious. And how did you guys feel? Were you weirded out at all by this performance? I mean, he's very creepy in this in a good way. Yeah. And he accomplishes that really to perfection here. The creep aspect. I mean, he's such a versatile actor. It really is incredible. And what's frustrating about it is, I've heard a lot of interviews with Steve Carell. I mean, he's done the late night circuit and everything promoting this. People have him on podcasts and such. Nobody ever mentions The Office.
I know.
In talking to him. Like, people just forget that was a part of his life. And that guy was on that show for almost a decade, you know. But do people just don't associate him with that show? And for me... Not just because I'm a fan of the show, but he was so closely associated with the character Michael Scott that for me, anything he does outside of that, I have to first remove the Michael Scottness from whatever he's doing and do that. I mean, did y'all have any of that in this movie? You know,
yeah,
it's kind of it's just weird to see him doing something so serious and be good at it. You know, it's very strange.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's he definitely
it's like Ace Ventura going and doing the Truman Show and be like, wow, I didn't expect that. That's kind of
but he tapered it a little bit, right? A lot more with something like Crazy Stupid Love, which is it's a comedic but more restrained performance. Little Miss Sunshine, which is a funny movie, but he's not really funny in it at all. Dan in Real Life, the aforementioned Seeking a Friend for the End of the Universe or whatever. So it wasn't way back.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Really dark character in that. It wasn't as so much as a, this is darker and more of a lead role. Cause a lot of times he's done supporting stuff in his more serious role, but this was definitely getting in. He definitely went into the steps of the pool instead of diving in like someone like Carrie did. But it didn't surprise me at all. And I would implore anyone that's listening, that's not an Office fan, even if you don't care for the comedy, I certainly understand. I love The Office personally, but I can get that the comedy of that show may not be for everyone. But just watch an episode of that. Just watch Carell and watch how nuanced that is and like how delicate that performance is. It's not a broad comedic part. There are parts, yes, where he screams and gets a laugh and things like that. But watch the little ticks and things like that. It really is a master class. And I think playing that character in the way he did, the way they wrote for it, really was an incredible lesson for him as an actor. And he came out of it. A really great actor. And the person I always compare him to is someone like Steve Martin, who's so funny and such a great comedic actor, but fits right in a serious movie if needed. Robin Williams, too. And so, yeah, it wasn't a surprise at all, Kent, to answer your question.
Yeah.
It wasn't weird to see him do something serious at all. It was weird because the character was weird. Whatever creepiness or weirded outness I felt was certainly authentic to that role.
Yeah, the roles like this that I always compare it to is that Robin Williams performance in One Hour Photo. It just – there's something about performances. I know a compared one earlier this year. I think Jake Gyllenhaal in Nightcrawler I compared it to. Just to kind of you don't know whether you're going to trust – you should trust the guy or not. I mean, you know, John DuPont, this is the perfect example of that. In Channing Tatum's character of, is this guy for real? You know, is he really going to give me all that I want and lead me to the Olympics, or does this guy have ulterior motives? And he keeps you guessing the entire movie. Let's talk about his weirdness a little bit. Steve Carell's character, the scene where they're doing cocaine in the helicopter.
Yeah.
Kind of crazy, very memorable scene, I will admit, but, this guy's freaking nuts, John DuPont. I knew nothing about this guy. I knew about the DuPont family and the DuPont Corporation, of course, but had no idea the background of that. And if this guy was like this, what an insane human being to go purchase a tank and then get upset that it doesn't have a 50 caliber machine gun attached to it. Like, what is this guy's deal? I was very intrigued by just what the heck was up with John DuPont. And I think that's mainly this movie. Like I said before, I expected a lot more to happen in this movie. There to be more twists and turns, there to be more of a story. Like Moneyball is such an interesting movie. In my opinion, you know, things happen and it's really very cleverly written and well done. There's a lot to learn in that one. And I'm not big into wrestling, you know, Olympic style wrestling.
Yeah, you're a WWE guy.
I'm straight, only MMA, you know, but Bellator, only off brand MMA, not UFC.
Kid wears only tap out gear.
I mean, it took a lot for me to gain an interest in this subject matter, and what kept me interested was the DuPont character. And now I know that's the point of this movie, but to me, I was just wondering if it was going to be. If it was going to turn into a movie at any point, like in Nightcrawler, where when Gyllenhaal's character goes to the house and then witnesses the murder, that's when it turned into a movie to me, you know? And I was waiting for that moment here, and it really just felt more like the story of Mark Schultz, who's Channing Tatum's character's relationship with Carell's character. That's really the movie. And then, you know, Ruffalo's character is, of course, thrust into it all. But I just wanted to reiterate that, yeah, I expected a little bit more to happen in the movie, but what did happen kept me interested. And, you know, this guy's a talented director, Bennett Miller.
Really is.
He really knows how to even use music to a great effect. I mean, that's not said enough nowadays in movies, is that somebody knows how to pick songs and score a film and knows when to use music and fade down the natural sound of something. I mean, there are several scenes in the movie where there's no sound and it's just showing, you know, the wrestling trials or something. And all you hear is music and you see yelling, you see fans going crazy, but you don't hear the fans going crazy. And, man, Bennett Miller is talented, and I'll reiterate that. And he does deserve to be, thought of in the new upper echelon. I think this movie will do it for him though. I think this movie will gain him a little bit more respect, a lot more respect, actually.
Yeah, and Futterman, too, who's the screenwriter who also wrote Moneyball and Capote with Miller, or wrote and then Miller directs, is also who's an actor, who's the son in The Birdcage. A lot of people don't know that. Was in A Mighty Heart and a few other things, too. But is an excellent writer. I think these scripts are really good, and they don't try to be there's something kind of great about well, this is the dumbest statement ever, but there's something great about the dialogue of someone like Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson. And not only is it good, but it's showy in a certain way. And there's ideas being – with Tarantino, that's more just the beauty, almost musicality of it. With someone like PTA, it's the kind of philosophical ideas behind the dialogue. And that's great. And it's good because it's good. And it's also good because it's showy in a way. It's kind of – showing off. And what I like about Miller's scripts is that they're not really. And I don't mean, and that sounds like the most backhanded insult ever. They are, the dialogue is interesting, but it's not showy at all.
Yeah.
And it's grounded in a weird way. And it doesn't, it just, it's really
minimal.
It's not
minimal. Poetry. It just says what needs to be said.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it doesn't ever attempt, there's never a line that's weird or, you know, I thought Moneyball really was excellent in terms of that. And that's a movie that I have a few issues with. I didn't like it as much as some, but it's really good. And in a lot of ways, but I think I read the book and I was just confused by the movie is probably my issue.
No, I'm with you, Richard. I'm much more, I thought Foxcatcher was a much better movie than.
Did you like Capote?
Yeah. Capote's fine. I've watched it one time and that'll probably be the only time I ever watch it. It's not a movie that I have any desire to
see again.
And this is probably closer to that on that scale, whereas Moneyball, I would be, you know, be happy to watch Moneyball again. I just don't think to your point, Kent, I'm the opposite of you on this. I was never that interested in the story of Moneyball, probably because I knew the story of Moneyball and I know that it ends in an ALCS and no one cares, you know? And I was much more interested in the story of like, what the heck is going to happen with this guy than I was with anything within Moneyball. And again, that's not to slight Moneyball. It's just, this was a much more compelling, interesting and thrilling thing to me than Moneyball ever was.
No, definitely. You know what this movie and Moneyball do have in common, though, Brian?
What's that?
They both completely leave out Mulder, Hudson, and Zito. So that's
yeah,
they do. Moneyball was my number one of 2011.
Oh wow!
I'm remembering correctly. I think yours was Drive that year, Brian.
It was.
Brian.
Yeah.
That was a down year because I remember Girl with a Dragon Tattoo being high on my list that year.
Yeah,
as
that was
well.
A strange,
so, very
it was
strange
an odd year. I was looking at my list the other day, just kind of getting a feel for all that stuff. And Drive is a movie that I saw once and I never want to see again because I had this great experience with it in the theater. And I'm 100% sure that if I saw it again, it would downgrade significantly. And I don't ever want that to happen. I really enjoyed that movie the one time.
There's
but
some good movies that
the last Harry Potter movie was a great movie. 50/50 is a great movie that no one ever talks about. And Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy came out that year too.
Yeah, Midnight in Paris and Ghost Protocol also.
Yeah,
but it's cool though because The Artist won Best Picture. So
that's right.
Which again, we haven't mentioned this in a while. The Artist.
Yeah.
By far, leaps and bounds.
Yes, this is not questionable. So,
not
up for debate. Yeah,
but we will say, and we're not afraid to make statements like that. Super 8 also that year, but The Artist, the best black and white film of 2011, maybe even the decade. Even the decade.
You mean the best silent film of 2011?
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. Best silent. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Let me rephrase that. Best silent film.
There's probably some art house movie that's in black and white that contends with it at least, but silent black and white movie. Definitely.
Best one of at least that 3-year period. You can't argue it.
Yeah. I'm willing to give it a 5-year span even just to.
For me with Moneyball, when we talked about in the past, the front office aspect of professional sports is such a cool thing to get a behind the scenes look at if it's done correctly, i.e. Moneyball. If it's not done correctly, i.e. Draft Day, it can be a piece of crap. But Moneyball was such a refreshing look at something that could have actually happened and did happen. So I like the interpretation there. There's just so many memorable scenes. I don't want this to be a Moneyball podcast, but there's a lot of great memorable moments in that movie. But
Brian and I have an announcement, and I'll just go ahead and take this one, Brian. But we have – Brian and I have been working on a little side project, Kent, and we want you to direct it, but we haven't brought it to you yet. But we are working on a – behind the scenes front office on film on the Houston Rockets with Jeremy Piven as Daryl Morey.
Oh gosh. Count me out. No. Not if I had to work.
You sure?
Yeah.
Kimbo Slice plays James Harden.
Oh, well, in that case.
Maybe he'll knock out Jeremy Piven. Dancing baby from the 2000s plays Dwight Howard.
I'm in.
In blackface.
Let's close out our thoughts here on Foxcatcher. Is there anything spoilery specific we should talk about? Should we go into spoilers before we end
this?
Yeah,
we should probably talk about the conclusion.
Okay, yeah. Spoilers coming up now.
They win the Olympics.
Spoilers coming up now for Foxcatcher. Brian, how did you feel about the end?
I thought it was great because I was into the thriller aspect of the movie, and I just had this – you just know – for me at least, I knew something bad is going to happen at some point. At some point, this is all going to come to a head. I didn't know what it was going to be. I didn't know anything about this story, and that probably helped. When that – I mean, it's just so – it was, to me at least, it was so shocking and violent the way that it goes down, where he shoots Mark Ruffalo's character – Steve Carell's character shoots Mark Ruffalo's character, and it's I thought it was a very effective payoff for 2 hours of tension, and that's always the kicker, I think, with a thriller or any kind of tense situation sort of movie. Like, you've got to have a great or a powerful or a shocking ending to kind of to make it all worthwhile. And for me, it totally worked. And so I thought it was there were people in my theater. And again, I was seeing it with kind of an odd audience, and it's an older crowd and whatnot. But there were probably a dozen or so people that literally like gasped very loud and kind of had the scream and all that stuff, because it kind of comes out of nowhere. He's just driving. He's talking to Schultz, and then Dan Schultz, and then all of a sudden his gun is out, and 10 seconds later he shoots, and then there's a couple more shots, and I was very impressed with the way that Bennett Miller pulled that off. It kind of made the entire movie pull together for me in a bit of an odd way, because it's very tragic and horrible and everything, but just from a movie making standpoint, it really, really hit home and really worked for me.
Yeah, I want to mention real quick John DuPont's relationship with his mother, that is also hammered home by Bennett Miller here. A lot of his motivation seems, or John DuPont's motivation seems to come from his need to impress his mother or seek approval from his mother. So Vanessa Redgrave plays Jean DuPont.
Yeah.
And I liked how they depicted that, especially the scene at the end when he releases all the horses, John DuPont releases the horses from the farm and everything. It's really sad that all this was for that, you know. And I think there's other motivations here. I think, and Steve Carell's been asked this and talked about it, but it wasn't something that Miller really wanted to. It wasn't something that Miller really wanted to hammer home. The fact that John maybe had feelings for some of these wrestlers, Mark Schultz, like, feelings of love, you know,
romantic
feelings towards these people.
Yeah. You did kind of leave that up in the air. And I think if you've been following the Mark Schultz Twitter debacle, I guess is a fair enough word at this point. I think Mark Schultz definitely took that from the movie, that there was some sort of underlying homosexual relationship between the two of them.
Yeah. I think it's to be expected. And, I think it should be talked about. I think that was that certainly has to do with how his character ends up, and maybe even sees Ruffalo's family life, and maybe is sort of jealous of that aspect of his life and everything, and just maybe leads to more of his motivation to kill him later in the movie.
It's a very odd – it's worth the listener, and you guys as well, if you haven't done so, it's worth kind of looking up some of the background on – all of this and John DuPont in particular, because dude was straight crazy. And there's a lot of really weird things from his life, especially his life during this time period, that are completely nuts. And I think Bennett Miller did a great job of picking what to put in and what to pull out, because that's a major part. I don't consider this necessarily a biopic, but that's the major issue we have a lot of times with biopics, is like, there's just so much overstuffing and trying to fit all this stuff into one movie. I thought he did a great job of like picking what do we put in and what do we leave out. But it's definitely worth looking up because there's a lot of – I mean, there was a lot of crazy stuff going on with this guy at this point.
Yeah. Richard, thoughts on the end?
Yeah. Unlike you two, I was very, very familiar with the story. And so I was really interested in your point of view, because I didn't think you guys were – So I think most people watching it will have the reaction you guys have had, and that's awesome that it was so effective and things. I was the rare case where I had read about this a lot for some reason. Before this movie's even been made, I someone referenced it at some point in my life, and I looked it up, and then kind of, it's such a weird story, it's easy to kind of obsess over. And so it was, you know, it was the Serial podcast before Serial, I guess. And it was a really interesting case. So I knew, you know, that DuPont would murder Schultz, but it was done beautifully. It's a weird thing to say, but
yeah,
it was done really well.
Before we give grades, I just have to mention the scene where Channing Tatum finds out he won't be competing, goes nuts in the hotel room.
Man.
That's the moment where I was like, okay, this is a nomination. Yeah. Like just show that, where he smashes his head into the mirror and punching himself constantly in the face and ends up going crazy and, gaining all that weight and stuff. And when he smashes his head into the mirror, and it's all one take, and you see just shards of glass sticking out of his head and blood. I mean, Bennett Miller had to have been behind the lens like, holy crap, did that really just happen on film? I mean, that was just an incredible moment.
But I feel like it was cheapened a little bit when he got on the merry-go-round thing right after that.
Well, he jumped on it backwards, so
yeah.
It was actually pretty impressive.
Yeah,
looking back,
when he was John DuPont the whole time, I was like, "Wow,
that is weird."
Crazy. That was crazy.
Let's move on to grades, guys. I'm going to give this a minus. Not it's up there for me this year. It ranks, you know, outside of the, I mean, in the bottom five of the top 10, probably for me at this point.
Okay.
It's up there. I mean, I think it's. I need more consideration to find out where it will ultimately end up. But for me, this is an A-. Solid movie. Very good performances. I think the performances outperform the movie itself. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. So
sure.
I'll give it A-. Brian?
It's in straight A for me. And it's in the top 10. I would, as far as just straight Oscar contenders go, for me at this point, and there's still a few we haven't seen, but for me, it's Boyhood and Birdman, and this would probably come in third at this point for me. So,
maybe, yeah.
Richard,
I think I'm going to cover the spectrum here on the A's. I think I'm going to give this an A+.
Ooh,
wow,
cool,
nice.
This is number one for you, Richard, this year.
It's definitely top two. I think there's one more that's slightly ahead of it, and that would probably be Boyhood.
Draft A.
Ah. I thought you'd be a Birdman guy.
I thought I would too. But Boyhood has stuck with me more than Birdman.
Yeah. I'm stuck between Birdman and Boyhood, honestly.
Birdman's incredibly technical, as is Boyhood. Birdman is philosophically important, but not really important to one's life, whereas Boyhood's the opposite.
I feel like I felt last year about Gravity and 12 Years a Slave. Gravity, monumental film. I'll never see a movie like that. I was blown away by the achievement of that film. Same way with Birdman. 12 Years a Slave, wow. I mean, it sticks with you. You think about it a lot. You're just, when it's all said and done, you look back and be like, okay, that's the best picture of the year. You know, there's no denying it. And I feel that way about Boyhood. It's like, what are we even doing sometimes talking about any other movie? Because Boyhood, it might end up sweeping it this year. I mean,
yeah.
Boyhood was, it does, it sticks with you. So,
yeah, Boyhood is, I find, the one I compare the others to.
Yeah.
Maybe, and that may be a complete, symptom of me seeing it first.
Maybe.
But yeah. I really do think it's better in a weird way than all of these. It's just really good. And it's,
I won't be upset at all if it ends up like sweet. I mean, I think honestly, I told you guys this week, I'm putting in the call for Selma. I've heard Selma is just like an incredible film. So
yeah.
I think that one, when it, you know, come a month from now, will be the front runner.
I'm excited to see Selma. It is not doing well with the guilds, though.
Is it not?
Like, okay. It did not get a Producers Guild nomination. It didn't get a SAG. No, SAG doesn't do a best picture. They do like an ensemble. It didn't get a Writers Guild best picture nomination. But I've also heard that a big part of that is they haven't sent out screeners effectively. So there's a possibility that that gets corrected in time for the Academy.
Really hopeful about that too.
Yeah, there's still time for other films to make to work their way into this conversation. So
it's almost like with Selma that the entire guilds are living in North Texas because they can't get screeners.
Yep. Just can't see the movie, guys. Yeah, that's it.
Good conversation, guys. Good one, and I'm sure we'll talk about it come the end of the year when we talk best and worst of the year.
I'm really excited to do that episode in a week or two. I think that's going to be a fun one this year.
It will. Let's hit a quick week recommend before we get out of here.
Weekly recommend.
I'm going to recommend a documentary that I've been meaning to watch for a long time, and it's finally made its way online. It was actually shot a number of years ago, actually 5 years ago at this point. And it comes to us from one of our great friends and admirers of the podcast, our least favorite Franco, James Franco. He did this Saturday Night Live documentary called Saturday Night. It's an observational documentary where he basically just charts a week at SNL, what it's like to work there. And he does it for John Malkovich when he came and hosted I think in 2010.
Okay.
So a lot of familiar faces on there.
Good cast, yeah.
Bill Hader and Will Forte, to name a few, just carry the thing. I mean, their contribution to that show, especially Hader, is just incredible to witness. Also, John Mulaney, also Fred Armisen, of course. And a lot of great stuff. So, I mean, they show everything. They show the pitch meeting to the host, and then they show the first day of writing, which is Tuesday, which they basically everybody stays up for 24 hours straight writing their scripts. They, you know, they turn in 50 scripts to the producers, and then they do the table read, and so on and so forth. They take you through every aspect of a week at SNL. Really differently shot. I mean, not shot like a typical documentary, basically just more observational. Like I said, it's just a camera viewing what's going on. But anytime you can get a look at that world, really, really cool to see. It's on Hulu, right? I mean, if you sign up for the free trial, which is what I did, you can watch it. So,
what's it called?
Saturday Night.
Okay. So, I knew this was happening, but I wasn't aware that it was.
Yeah, yeah. It had happened, and there was big issues over the rights to it or something, because NBC technically owned the rights, but they wouldn't let it come out for a long time because they didn't want to ruin, I guess, reputations of anyone that was there on the show if they were still there or whatever. But it's out now, and you can finally watch it. It's called Saturday Night, and that's my recommend. So y'all like it. Y'all really like it. It makes me want Seth Meyers and John Mulaney back in the fold. Mm. Those guys really, really
good chance
talent
on one of those.
Yeah, really, seriously.
So on top of that, on top of your recommend, there's a website called 10 Minute Mail. Do you know what this is, guys?
No.
10 Minute Mail makes you a email address that expires in 10 minutes. All you have to do is copy and paste it, and you own it for 10 minutes. And then it self-destructs, and it's really useful for registering things like Hulu Plus for a week.
Ooh. Huh.
Just a tip.
That
so
is
go,
a good
go
tip.
Go create all these things. Go to 10minutemail.com, and it just generates you an email, and you use it, and you can access, if there's a confirmation email, you can access that for 10 minutes, and then it blows up. You never have to worry about it again until your 2 weeks run out, and then
that's a really good idea. Wow. I'll do that. What's your recommend, Richard?
Mine is a podcast I listened to today. We were talking about it a little bit earlier via Pigeon. We don't text. We actually send pigeons back and forth to each other's house. But the WTF podcast, which, as you guys know, stands for Where's the Farm?
Yeah. Yep.
Where
are you?
Yeah. but
Phil Dumpy, shout out.
Yeah, exactly. Classic Dumpy. But it has a director named Tyler Perry on today. No. Nice. A director named Paul Thomas Anderson on for 2 hours. Two-hour interview.
Paul Thomas Anderson or Paul W.S. Anderson?
No, you're right.
I'm only interested in the latter.
It's well, you're in luck because it's 2 hours of Resident Evil. Like you've never behind the scenes. Did you know Mila Jovovich originally didn't even want to do the first one? Can you imagine the directions it would have taken without her?
I just can't. No.
Well, get ready for 2 hours of what could have been. No, it's and Maron, who we are critical of sometimes, but sometimes he is good, does an excellent job of first off, not making it too much about him. He has his moments, but that's his bit, and I get that. But he really goes pretty much chronologically through, let's start with your childhood for 20 minutes, let's do Boogie Nights for 20 minutes, let's do Magnolia for 20 minutes, all the way up to Inherent Vice. And it's a really interesting, thought-provoking conversation. Paul Thomas Anderson is breathtakingly normal, which is so weird because his movies are not.
Yeah.
So really normal dude, funny, seemed to have a normal childhood. You know, Tarantino, his myth fits his personality. Mm-hmm. And Paul Thomas Anderson seems like Brian, like just like a guy. And it's a really interesting conversation. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. So you can go to WTFpod.com or subscribe on iTunes after you resubscribe to our podcast and check it out. It's he's someone that doesn't do a lot of interviews. And if you're interested in him at all or filmmaking in general, it's certainly a worthwhile listen. So, Brian, what's your recommend?
I'm just going to give you a trio of things we've talked about before, but that are relevant at this moment. Boyhood comes out on DVD Blu-ray tomorrow for us. So Tuesday it comes out. So if you have not seen Boyhood, and I know that was one that was limited release, it was kind of difficult to see for a lot of people, or maybe you've forgotten how great it was, definitely check that out, because that's going to be a huge, huge player in the coming weeks. My wife and I have been binging Americans season 2, and it's probably the best show on television. I know we've talked about Americans at length.
Oh, you're just now watching season 2. Wow.
Yes. We got behind and it got to a point where it was like, okay, we're not going to be able to catch up. So we're going to do the whole thing at one point.
It's good stuff.
I saw that season 3 is, you know, starting in a couple weeks. We probably ought to do an episode, a Rants and Raves episode on that, when season 3 is over. I'm not kidding. I really think it might be the best show on television right now.
Just telling you this, man. Been telling you.
I know you guys have, and it's my wife's fault. I'm totally going to blame it on her. Anything that I can watch by myself, I can binge in 2 days. But if I've got to wait for her, it takes time. So
yeah, we hate her. But
yeah, she's the worst.
What could matter, but what's important is not only do we have season 3 of the greatest show on television, Americans, it features American treasure, Uncle Tony Kornheiser.
That's right. So you know it's going to be even better. And then, you know what? Friends made it to Netflix this week. And that's probably the last great wide audience sitcom that we may ever have, honestly. And it holds up so well. You know, it doesn't look great because it's of when it was filmed. But that's a major cultural touchstone, I guess. And so if you've never seen... Everybody's seen some Friends, right? But if you've never watched the entire thing, I'll probably start my binge here. I got to get through Parks and Recreation again
before the
new season. What did I say?
Go ahead. Sorry, you were delayed.
Oh, sorry. So I probably start Friends after that. And at one point, it was my favorite show of all time. People are coming around on how good that show actually was. I think for a while it became kind of easy to bash on it. So check out any or all of those things.
It's definitely the show. You know, I don't think it's in my top 3 or maybe even 5 shows of all time. It's probably in my top 10. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely the show I've seen the most. I've spent more time with those characters probably than anything. It's weird to think about, but I've probably seen every episode of Friends 5, 6, 7 times.
Yeah, and there's a ton of episodes too.
Of episodes and syndication. And I know those characters inside and out, and it's weird. It is weird that I, you know, it probably is, if you were to like rate my brain activity, my favorite show of all time, but I wouldn't probably put it on there because it's not cool.
yeah, totally. No, that's a great way to put it. But I think we've reached a point where, especially with sitcoms, for whatever reason, like you're not – Big Bang Theory is the biggest show on TV right now, but you guys don't watch it, and I watch it, and it's, you know, it's fine. It doesn't have a cultural impact. It doesn't have a footprint the way sitcoms did at that time, the way Seinfeld does, the way Cheers and Friends and whatever else. You know, we love The Office. We've gone on and on about The Office 1,000 times on the show, but – you know, if I'm talking to my friends, I can talk about The Office. If I'm bringing up that show in the presence of like my coworkers or my parents or something like that, they don't get it. Whereas Friends, I think pretty much everybody has some kind of relation to that show.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's hard to believe that the show ended a decade ago.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that crazy. It was on a decade ago. No, it was over 10 years ago. It's crazy. I remember watching the final episode on TV. And
I remember taping it for Coach Starks, Kent. He came with me in the hallway. For listeners, we had this very cool, very young African-American basketball coach and teacher in our school. And he was always very worried about his street cred. And I was a pop culture nut. And he kind of knew that. He was my basketball coach. And he cornered me one time. He goes, "Richard, come in here. I need to talk to you real quick." And I said, "What's going on, coach?" And he goes, he looked around like, you know, he was trying to deal me drugs or something. And he goes, "Hey, you taping that Friends finale?" I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "You make me a copy of that?" I was like, "Sure." So I made him like this bootleg Friends copy. And he like had to, you know, give it to him in his car in the parking lot. Like it was some sort of Soviet document. One of my great high school memories.
Good recommends, Brian. I'll have to go check. I'll have to buy Boyhood, of course. And we do need to do an Americans episode. You're absolutely right.
That'd be fun.
I'm glad. Richard still needs to get on Fargo. We've been waiting for that one.
I do. Yes. I'll do that soon. I promise. Yeah. That's like when I say next to my queue, I really mean it. And keep in mind, Americans, when we talk about it, but I want everyone to know because I'm normally right about these things, and so are Brian and so are Kim, but so is Brian and so is Kim. But Matthew Rhys, remember that name?
So good, yeah, he's amazing. We House of Cards season 3 is premiering in a couple weeks as well, so I'm gonna need to go back and catch up back on House of Cards too. I love
you were Brian. House you were wild about season 2, right?
I don't know if I'm coming back for season 3. I haven't made my decision yet. I really liked season 1 a lot. Season 2 had like 5 or 6 really, really cool and interesting moments. By the end of season 2, I just, like, everybody else in the show is a complete idiot. And I have a hard time getting behind a show where the main characters get away with whatever they want to get away with because everyone else around them is a moron. Like,
yeah, no, I have a feeling
problematic.
That's what I'm waiting for in season 3 is for everything to just blow up.
I just don't feel like it is. Maybe this should be reserved for another episode, but I don't feel like there are any stakes on that show because if the president of the United States can himself like physically murder people and get away with it, there's no stakes anymore. Like he can do whatever he wants. He's untouchable.
Yeah.
That's the error of having the villain be the protagonist. It's hard to pull off logically.
Yes.
And on that note, Brian, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at BGill12. You can find my writing at canbabiesdrinkredbull.com. Richard, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Richard Barden. Kent, where can I find you?
On Twitter at Kent Garrison, and find all of our episodes online at badaboutmoviespodcast.com. Find our weekly recommends on there and contact the show on there as well. Just click contact. And on that note, we will see you next time at the cinema.
Bye.
Goodbye. Baby, I hear the blues are calling, tossed salad and scrambled eggs. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I've got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Scrambled eggs all over my face.
They're making me ya-ya. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs.
They're calling again.